You're listening to 5 Questions for a General, a production of the Modern War Institute at West Point. I am Dr. Charles Faint, the team lead for this podcast series, which features interviews of senior military leaders conducted by specially selected and trained West Point cadet hosts. These exchanges produce timely, relevant, and inspirational insights for professional development of leaders at all levels.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the West Point Class of 1974 Recording Studio and the 5 Questions for a General podcast. In this episode, Cadet Kalani Stewart sits down with retired Brigadier General Rich Gross for a discussion about communication, law, and decision-making in high-risk environments.
General, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Kalani. I appreciate it.
Can we start with a quick origin story? What made you want to join the Army, and what was your path?
So joining the Army was really thought more about coming to West Point. I hadn't really thought about the Army and came to the realization about Cal year, junior year, that, oh, the Army, I'm going to have to go there. But I wanted to come to West Point for 2 reasons. It was different and it was free. Free, we didn't have any money for college in my family. We had used the money apparently to buy a new house. And different, I wanted something. I didn't want to be like all my other high school classmates. So I walked into my high school guidance counselor's office. I found a brochure for West Point and I said, oh, this is different and it's free. And so I applied and fortunately got in. And then as I was looking at the Army itself, I really wanted to be an infantry officer. I mean, after going through Camp Buckner Infantry Week, I was just super excited about going into the infantry. So that's where I decided to go. But I knew I always at some point wanted to be a lawyer. So I applied for the Army's funded legal education program. The Army put me through law school, went to the University of Virginia. And as a captain, I went through law school and then became a judge advocate. And from there, went to the 101st. What was my first JAG assignment, and then several assignments after that. I was the legal advisor for Delta Force. I was the legal advisor for JSOC, as you pointed out, legal advisor for General McChrystal and his team at the International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan. I worked for General Mattis at CENTCOM. And then my final assignment was legal counsel to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs.
That's a perfect way to start our questions, sir. In your role as legal counsel to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, you advise not just the chairman, but the entire joint staff. Could you describe a challenge where interagency coordination was critical and how legal advice shaped the outcome?
Yeah, most of what we do as the Department of Defense, now Department of War, most of what we do involves interagency coordination. I mean, you just, some of the more tactical, maybe operational details might be devoid of interagency coordination, but at the joint staff level, it all goes through interagency coordination. So anytime we had an operation, whether it was a drone strike, whether it was a deployment to Afghanistan and Iraq, major issues like that, they went through some form of interagency coordination. And there's a whole policy coordination process that occurs at the National Security Council that the department is involved in and the joint staff. So in my role as legal advisor to the chairman, part of what I would do is I was part of what we call the interagency lawyers group. And so the National Security Council staff, a lawyer, they would convene the lawyers from State Department, from the Department of Justice, from DOD, the DOD General Counsel, the joint staff legal advisor, which was me. We'd have often the CIA's lawyer would be there, Treasury, if there were financial issues involved, sanctions and things like that. So we'd come together as an interagency legal group and we'd see if there was consensus. And so very often counterterrorism strikes in other countries would always involve interagency coordination, deployments, new operations, anything like that. So flipping your question, what didn't require interagency coordination? Very little. At that level, everything goes through an interagency coordination.
Okay, you spoke about the different kinds of legal advice that you get from different kinds of legal individuals. Was there a lot of disagreement when it came to that legal advice?
Surprisingly, no. And that was one of the couple gratifying things that I discovered working at that level. I was the only non-political person in the room. I mean, every other attorney had been appointed to their position by the president, confirmed by the Senate, but they were politicals. I mean, that doesn't mean they acted politically. It just means they were from the party of the administration in power at the time. And at the time it was President Obama. So they were all Democrats who had been appointed to their positions. So I was the only nonpartisan, apolitical individual in the room. I was a military attorney, but I was very gratified that they weren't being political about the decisions at hand. They were being very much, what does the law say? Not policy, but what does the law say and how do we best advise our clients on? You know, we would sometimes disagree around the edges, but I think for the most part, the core legal issues, I think we were able to come to a consensus. At the end of the day, there's something called the Office of Legal Counsel, OLC, at the Department of Justice, and they have kind of the final say on what the legal position is for the federal government. And they advise the attorney general, and it's the attorney general who is really the final say in what the law says as far as the executive branch is concerned. And then, of course, the courts can weigh in. But no, to answer your basic question, often there was consensus around the national security issues we face, and they were tough issues. I think the values that military lawyers brought to that group, besides being, you know, apolitical and nonpartisan, was we had that military perspective. And so one time, for example, we were, sure, I'll step into classified landmines here, but we were dealing with a legal issue involving some mining operations and with naval mines, anti-ship mines. And so as we were grappling with rules of engagement, it became clear to me that the civilian lawyers in the room, justice, the NSC, you know, the intel agencies and so forth, the State Department lawyers, none of them really understood the mechanics of mines or countermine operations. That's a very military topic. And so I actually gave them a PowerPoint presentation on mines, and so that they'd have a better understanding of the legal issues we were talking about. And so I think that's one of the values that military attorneys can bring to these conversations, because we're very comfortable with rules of engagement. We're very comfortable with military operations, and I think that helps.
Okay, thank you, sir. Continuing with that military perspective of your legal advice, in your 2014 interview with the International Review of the Red Cross, you discussed the evolving and often unsettled scope of international humanitarian law, including where and to whom it applies. That topic seems pretty particularly relevant now in the context of the Israel-Hamas war. With ongoing transformations in warfare, how do you see that scope continuing to evolve, especially concerning non-state actors?
Yeah, that's a great question. So just for our listeners who may not be familiar, international humanitarian law is what most of the world calls what we call the law of armed conflict, and what some people will still call the law of war. And so as we think through, it's a body of law that really dictates when can force be used, how much force against whom, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, that's what military JAGs are trained in. We're trained in the law of armed conflict, and we're very comfortable with it. But it's not like you can go pull a law book off a shelf and every nation has agreed to what does the international humanitarian law say. Some of it is found in treaties, you know, treaties that dictate the use of weapons or landmines or things like that. The law of the sea and so forth. There may be a treaty out there that says that, but a lot of the law of armed conflict is really based on what we call state practice. What are the states, what have they done over the course of history that they kind of have come to not a consensus, but everybody agrees this is what the law says. Now, some of it, again, we get from the Geneva Conventions and the Hague Regulations and different treaties. But because of that complexity, you know, military lawyers and really all practitioners in the law of war have to look for, you know, what is the state practice in this area? The International Committee of the Red Cross, who puts out that review and did that interview, they kind of see themselves as experts in the law of armed conflict, or as they would say, IHL, International Humanitarian Law. But not every nation agrees with them on what the law says. So it can be really complex. Super complex in situations like the one you mentioned. And I'm not even going to begin to try to unpack that situation and what the law says there. And there are going to be disagreements about them. I mean, people are going to be uncomfortable. But as you said, in World War II, we traditionally faced a nation state group of military soldiers in uniform against another nation state group of soldiers in uniform. And so the lines were clear. relatively clear. And so it was easy to tell who's a non-combatant, what's a military objective and what's a civilian objective and so forth. And, but now, as you pointed out, you know, you have people in that look like farmers by day, but they might be insurgents at night or terrorists. And, you know, and we struggled with this in Afghanistan and Iraq, trying to figure out, is that person a combatant? Can they be legally targeted? Do we have to wait until they're a threat to us, or can, you know, is their status as a combatant set by the conditions they're operating under? And so it can be really complex for all JAGs, but particularly young JAGs on their first assignment over there. It can be a real challenge.
You've also emphasized that teaching humanitarian law through vignettes and role play can embed principles far more effectively than pure classroom methods. Can you share a memorable example, perhaps from deployments, where hands-on training significantly impacted legal compliance on the ground?
Yeah, that's a good question too. If you just slap up PowerPoint slides and say, these are the rules of engagement, this is the law of armed conflict, this is what you have to do, it just doesn't stick. Yeah, like most things. I mean, it whether it's ethics or other areas of law or policy, if you try to teach it by PowerPoint, it just is, you know, you see it on the screen and then you're on to the next challenge. And it can be really difficult for soldiers to remember, for JAGs to remember, frankly. And so we discovered early on that vignette training is better. If you take somebody through a scenario and have a discussion about it, that's better, even better than that at the training centers. And so we've seen this at the national training centers now. They'll incorporate, you know, scenarios into the training where there's a law of armed conflict situation. And I've seen that before, you know, on the ground at Fort Polk. We were preparing board of the National Training Center. I haven't been out there myself, but I know that, you know, they've got that built into the training exercises. And even at Fort Bragg and Fort Campbell, when I was there, they would build in scenarios to the situation. The funniest one I remember the most is I was a lieutenant in the 82nd Airborne and we were on a training exercise. And little did I know they had built in a legal issue. They were looking to build a legal issue into the training exercise we were doing. And the battalion top was overrun, the tactical operations center. The battalion top was overrun, and my platoon was supposed to be the ones who guarded it. And because the lieutenant was sleeping, and the lieutenant was me, they got overrun at a training exercise. And so the next night, we're called to a meeting of all the lieutenants, and the company commander starts reading my rights and for failure to perform my duty. And I thought my career was over. And as it turned out, it was a training exercise. Everybody knew but me, and I nearly passed out. I mean, I nearly fainted. I was so scared. I thought my career was over, but it was just part of the training. The JAGs had wanted something in the exercise to train long-term conflict and failure to do your duty. I didn't think it was funny. Every other lieutenant in the company thought it was hilarious. But it was I learned a great lesson from that. First of all, don't sleep through an attack, but also learn that, you know, that the long-term conflict is serious. But I think everybody involved in that, because it was so stressful at the time, especially for me, I think it just trained that concept that, you know, that in this case, it was more military justice issues in a training exercise, but you get the idea. Having that vignette built into the training, frankly, very painful for me.
But it sounds like the lessons don't closely come.
It's stuck very well.
So one of the things you do in retirement is leadership consulting. Do you think there's any relevance in military leadership and decision making to similar functions in the business world?
We it's funny. I work for Thayer Leadership, and we teach Army and West Point leadership techniques to civilian companies. And one of the things we teach is the after action. We teach leaders' intent. We teach all of these great tools that the Army uses to get the most out of their teams, to learn, to let your teams, you know, tell your teams what needs to be done and why, let them figure out the how. Companies will come to us and they think that what we're doing is, you know, we just order people around and people will do exactly what we tell them to do, which is not how it works. And so when we teach these great techniques that the Army has developed over hundreds of years, they are very relevant to how civilian companies work. And I think we've seen companies use, for example, the after action review. You know, you've just done an operation, you've just done an exercise. You do an after-action review. What was supposed to happen? What actually happened? What did you learn? Who else needs to know? And the Army, that's very routine in the Army. You'd be amazed how many civilian companies don't do that at all. And they don't have a mechanism to take these lessons learned. And so when they see these Army techniques, they just think it's magic. I mean, they really just love what we do in the Army and what we teach at West Point. And so I think the principles of leadership will work across different industries, different companies, and so forth. And we've seen some great success out of companies using what the Army's been doing.
Okay. And in a previous interview you did with the Brief Lab team, you talked about the importance of teaching senior leaders how to craft concise and impactful communication. Could you share an anecdote where disciplined brevity made a critical difference in board decision making at the tactical or strategic level?
Well, at the strategic level especially, but I think at all levels, busy leaders don't have time to read 18-page email or an 18-page, 20-page document on a particular issue. And so what I learned even before I dealt with the Brief Lab, what I learned just as a military officer, you know, first of all, if you could just start with a concise headline, a bottom line up front, and tell the leader that you're dealing with, here's what this communication is about, whether it's a briefing, whether it's an email, or just a one-page info paper. Here's the bottom line up front. And also as part of that, do I need a decision from you, or am I just telling you this for your information? You listen differently. We all listen differently. If we know something, I have to make a decision at the end of this conversation, or whether I'm just getting it for information. And so we start with that, the bottom line up front, and then crafting a very concise explanation of exactly what it is that's going on and what's needed. I had a boss who, if he had to scroll an email, wouldn't read it, couldn't read it, didn't have time. If you had more than three bullets, he didn't have time because he was so busy and just being flooded by data and information. And I can only imagine it's gotten worse. And so the real art is to be able to take an issue and boil it down very clear and concise, and make it stick. And so I had a situation, for example, with the chairman who, you know, was asking me about the use of force against another nation. We had an issue come up. He knew he was going to get asked, when can you lawfully use force against another nation? Or use force on their territory, for example. And so I boiled it down very simply, very concisely. Here are the international legal bases for use of force. Well, it turned out later that day, he appeared before Congress and got asked that question by a senator and nailed it. I mean, just nailed it. And I was so happy. It's on YouTube. And I was so happy because he was able to just very clearly lay out, here are the three internet bases for use of force in international law. And it was a proud moment. And so that's, if I'd given him a 20-page paper on use of force, not sure it would have stopped. But I gave him three simple bullets, which captured the essence of the law, and he got it.
That's a good story, sir. Things aren't always so clear and concise, though. You wrote a research paper titled Different Worlds, Unacknowledged Special Operations and Covert Action. In that paper, you described how the blurred operational lines between Title 10 and Title 50 authorities affect special operation missions. Can you explain to our audience what Title 10 and Title 50 are and the effects those authorities have?
It's an interesting issue, and actually, I think it still comes up. But I've been out of the building, as they say, for about 10 years. But Title 10 is kind of shorthand for Title 10 of the U.S. Federal Code. And Title 10 of the U.S. Federal Code primarily gives all the authorities to the Secretary of Defense, now Secretary of War, for everything. I mean, Title 10 has everything from how much a cadet at West Point gets paid, how much a second lieutenant gets paid, to the structure of the joint staff and everything in between. I mean, it is a comprehensive body of law covering everything that involves the Defense Department. Sometimes I'd get a call, hey, Judge, can you send me a copy of Title 10? And it's multiple volumes of law books from the U.S. Federal Code. And so they didn't know what that meant. So Title 10, though, became shorthand in special operations community, and then that spread to the interagency for a military operation, a traditional military operation. Title 50 is the section of U.S. federal code that deals with all the intelligence activities of the U.S. federal government, whether that's the intelligence agencies like the National Security Agency, the Central Intelligence Agency, the Defense Intelligence Agency, all those intel agencies fall under Title 50 to include a lot of authorities that the Secretary of Defense has with his or her intelligence activity. But Title 50 became shorthand for covert. And so when people would say, should that be a Title 10 operation or a Title 50 operation, what that really meant was, should the military do that or should the other guy? And so the whole point of the paper was to try to unpack all that. And I didn't solve it. This one, by the way, a 2009 War College paper. But, and other people have since written War College papers on the topic. It comes up all the time. The last time it really kind of got into the public view, if you remember when they went and got Bin Laden, there was a lot of discussion because it was a U.S. military unit, but it fell under the director of national intelligence, or actually the director of the CIA, ran the operation under Title 50. So it became a covert operation, technically, although they announced it the next day, that it had been successful. But that was an example of, was it Title 10 or Title 50? Well, you had Title 10 forces, but they were under the command, if you will, in air quotes, of the director of the CIA to do what was a Title 50 operation, even though it. So it's just a confusing area of the law. I think the bigger lesson for me and probably for folks listening is, you know, when you have those kind of big, confusing kind of topics, I think part of what a lawyer does, a military lawyer, is try to explain those and make them understandable. First of all, we have to understand the full breadth of the law and the policy behind those things. But then we have to be able to explain it to our clients, commanders, and so that they can better understand it and they know the limits of their authority. Just like when I explained to the chairman exactly, you know, you're just enough for him to be able to go and brief at a Senate hearing. It's similarly when a commander comes and says, hey, explain the difference between Title 10 and Title 50. I've got to be able to explain that in a way that it's useful to her, but also that they can use that information in their day-to-day operations without, I'm not going to get 4 hours to sit there and give them a PowerPoint briefing. I've got to be able to make it understandable. I think that's the real lesson. We have to know our business up and down, but we have to then do it pretty precisely and concisely for our clients.
Sir, so over your extensive career, you've been taken from JSOC to CENTCOM to ISAF and deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan. Knowing what you know now, what's one leadership lesson in a fast-paced, high-risk environment that you pass on to the next generation of military leaders?
There's a couple. The first one, and I tell military lawyers this, but I think it fits other specialties, other branches and so forth. But I would always tell military lawyers, don't be a dentist. And listen, I love dentists. Dentists are important. No offense to the dentists out there. But if you think about the dentist model, they're sitting in their office. They wait for you to come to them with a problem. They fix your problem. You go away. Maybe 6 months later, you come back. That model works very well for them. I don't think it works well for a military lawyer. I don't think it works well for a military leader. And so, you know, you can imagine if the dentist lived with you and watched how you brushed your teeth and watched how you flossed and told you to quit eating so much sugar, you have amazing teeth, but you don't want a dentist doing that. On the other hand, for a military lawyer, an operational lawyer, you've got to be fully involved in your client's business. You've got to go to all the meetings. You've got to pay attention. You've got to know what's going on. People aren't going to come to you often and say, hey, is this a problem? You've got to be out there listening, paying attention. And, you know, I would go to all sorts of meetings and often would never say a word, but I was listening. I was paying attention. And I can't tell you how many issues I headed off before they became problems because I'd overheard it. I was able to go quietly to somebody and say, hey, listen, I think what you're proposing violates. I actually had to do that. And so don't be a dentist. You have to be out and about in your client's business. And when I became a civilian general counsel in a civilian company in Tennessee, you know, I surprised people. I started showing up for meetings and they were like, why are you here? I said, I'm just here to listen. And I would. I'd listen and pay attention. And I was amazed how much information I was able to pick up. And again, head off problems before they became big problems, just because I was listening and paying attention and I was assessing people. So that's probably my biggest advice to people is don't be a dentist. Get out and about. It's way too easy to sit back and do, you know, text or emails and not be fully involved in what's going on in your organization. And I think it's important for people to get out there. The other thing I would always tell, especially younger lawyers, the first one is that, in the words of the amazing Ferris Bueller, life moves pretty fast. And so it's a real tendency, particularly younger officers, to just fully immerse themselves in their careers. And that's wonderful. But you really do need to step back occasionally and make sure you're spending time with your kids, spending time with your family, taking some time for yourself, for self-care, for your hobbies, for your faith, if you have one, or for civic order, whatever it is that makes life worth living. You can't just totally immerse yourself. And so I think it's so important to make sure you pull back occasionally, not occasionally, regularly, and pay attention to life, because all of a sudden my kids are grown and out of the house now. I'm so thankful I spent the time with them. When I wasn't employed, I was with my wife and kids. We did what they wanted to do. I didn't go golf all day on Saturday or do, fish or do anything like that. I spent time with my family. And I think that was, I'm so thankful I did, because it goes fast. And the other piece of advice I give folks is, you only get one chance. You ought to do what you want to do. I'll never forget when I was being considered to be the legal advisor to Delta Force, and I had a good friend and a fellow JAG said to me, if you take that job, you'll never get promoted. And I was a major at the time, the commander general staff guard. He said, you'll never get promoted. And I said, what? I said, he said, no, it's just too weird. It's out of the mainstream. It's just, nobody understands it. It's just, you should turn that job down. And I thought, I really want to do this. It sounds really cool. And so I just said, I'm going to do it. And maybe I won't get promoted. Maybe that's the way it is, but I think I'll have fun. It worked out okay. I did get promoted. I continued to get promoted. I had some of the most amazing adventures. Adventure may sound like too strong a word, but I thought it was an adventure. And I met amazing people, and I got to see and do amazing things. And so you've only got one shot. You ought to do what you want to do. To the degree you can pick. Do what you want to do. Just let the chips fall where they may.
Thank you, sir. General Gross, thank you for your time today and for this great conversation about communication, law, and decision-making in high-risk environments. On behalf of Colonel Pat Sullivan, the director of the Modern War Institute, and Dr. Charlie Fink, the director of this podcast series, it's my pleasure to present you with this rare and coveted MWI Travel Club.
Thank you very much. Now I enjoy the conversation.
This has been an episode of 5 Questions for a General, a production of the Modern War Institute of West Point. If you like what you heard today, please download, like, subscribe, and share this podcast to help us reach an even larger audience. All statements in this podcast represent the personal views of the speakers and do not represent an official position of the United States Military Academy or the United States government.